Good morning. This is Dan Arshak, and you're listening to the Criminal Law Show on WGXC 90.7 FM. We have a very interesting show today for you. Our guest is Joel Rudin. I trust I haven't pushed any of the wrong buttons and that he's still online and ready to speak to us. Joel, are you still there?
Still here.
Wonderful. We'll be right with you. The Criminal Law Show addresses a variety of issues in which criminal law affects people's lives. I'm a criminal defense lawyer. I've been one for 30 years. I practice in Catskill and in Manhattan, in federal courts, in state courts, and I practice in jurisdictions around the world as well. All of my practice is representing people charged with crimes, and many times people ask me, how do you represent those people? I can tell you that I've given a lot of thought to how I can represent those people. I feel it's the thing that ethical people would do. And over time, I've discovered that there's a wonderful song that I want you to listen to that explains how it is that we can represent people charged with crimes. Well, maybe we won't be listening to that today. Perhaps what we'll do is go straight to Joel. I want to take an opportunity to tell you a little bit about who he is and what he does. Joel's practiced law for almost 30 years, almost all that time in New York. He has been a criminal defense attorney for most of that time. Over the course of the last several years, he has focused on addressing issues of prosecutorial misconduct. You know that in the criminal justice system, there are three pillars that support us. One is the judges, one is the criminal defense attorneys, and the other are the prosecutors. We need to rely on the ethics and professionalism of each of those pillars to have a criminal justice system that we can be proud of. Unfortunately, Joel has found, and many criminal defense attorneys and many defendants have found, that over the course of time, those pillars that support our system are undermined by corruption and inappropriate behavior. Joel has been honored several times for his work, which includes obtaining reversals of convictions and extraordinary monetary compensation for individuals who should not have been convicted because of the misconduct of prosecutors. Let me introduce Joel to you now. Joel, you're still with us, yes?
Still here.
Wonderful.
Unlike your song.
Yeah, unlike my song, that didn't seem to go too well. I don't know what the problem is with that. Perhaps we'll come back to it later. Joel, why don't you talk to us a little bit about what brought you to doing this work and why you focus on prosecutorial misconduct in the work that you do?
Well, I suppose I'm a child of the '60s. I was a teenager in the '60s. I was inspired by the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam War movement, and sympathized with those who were fighting what seemed to be the excesses of the government. And originally, I wanted to be a journalist, an investigative reporter, and I was a reporter for about a year between college and law school, but I found that maybe it's because of where I was working, I wasn't able to do the kind of work that I wanted to do, and it seemed like law would give me the tools to either go back to journalism and be more effective or to promote change as a lawyer, and I ended up becoming a lawyer. And I was always interested in criminal defense, and found myself sympathizing with the underdog, with the defendant, again, as opposed to the all-powerful government. Became a criminal defense lawyer, and for many years was doing a combination of trial work and appellate work, and then began to get involved in cases where prosecutors had withheld evidence or engaged in misconduct and caused often innocent people to be convicted.
So, Joel, we all read the papers and we understand that there are different actors in the criminal justice system. We perhaps on a general basis understand that that judges are supposed to make sure that the law is applied fairly, and defense attorneys are obviously supposed to defend people who are charged with crimes. How do you define what the job of a prosecutor is?
Well, the prosecutor, the defense attorney, has one obligation, and that is to fight for the interests of his or her client. But the prosecutor wears two hats. The prosecutor, on the one hand, is the attorney for the state and is representing the interests of the state in prosecuting a criminal case. But at the same time, the prosecutor is wearing a second hat, which is he's sort of an arm of the court, and he's supposed to be interested in justice, not only in winning. So the prosecutor, I mean, and it makes for a difficult job. On the one hand, prosecutors, like defense lawyers, can be very competitive and have egos, and they want to win. But at the same time, they have to keep in mind that they're there to see that justice is done, and winning is not always justice.
Well, prosecution is designed to make sure that justice is done. We watch television shows on a regular basis and see that it seems as though what prosecutors try to do more than anything else is win their case. Is there a tension between seeing that justice is done and winning a case?
Absolutely, and that's why prosecutors have a very difficult job in our system. Sometimes a prosecutor may be aware of information or of evidence that will undercut their case, even if they believe the defendant is guilty. For example, as defense lawyers, we've all represented clients who have become witnesses in cases, either because they're not charged or they make deals with the prosecution. And we all have been there where prosecutors have interviewed our clients, and our clients initially have not told the truth, or at least have given a version of the truth that is different from what they end up testifying to at trial. And then the prosecutors don't take notes, they don't make reports, and they don't disclose the information to defense counsel.
And they have an affirmative obligation, they have a duty to make those sorts of disclosures, isn't that right?
Yes. In 1963, the Supreme Court decided a case called Brady v. Maryland, and the rule of that case, which applies to every criminal prosecution in this country, is that if the government, the prosecution, becomes aware of evidence that tends to favor the defendant, and the evidence is significant enough that it might affect the outcome of the trial, then they're obligated to turn it over to the defense. And that's because if they don't do that, then there's a greater risk that an innocent person may be convicted. And also there's an uneven, the two sides are not even in terms of their resources. When the police begin investigating a case, they have often many detectives or officers available to interview every conceivable witness and to gather as much information as possible. The prosecution has the grand jury where they can compel people to testify. But once an arrest is made, the criminal defense attorney has none of those, or usually has none of those resources. I mean, every now and then you have someone who's very wealthy who can afford a limitless defense and can match the resources of the prosecution, but that's very rare. Most criminal defendants in this country are indigent. They have an attorney assigned who is being paid an hourly rate by the state that generally is very low. They have very limited access to investigators and to experts to assist their defense, and they don't have the right to compel witnesses to testify or to be interviewed, even to be interviewed by them. They don't have the grand jury. So in order to level the playing field at least a little bit, the Supreme Court decided back in 1963 that when the government has information that favors the defense, they must turn it over. But that, of course, is in tension with the desire of the prosecutor to win his case. And what I see happening over and over again is that prosecutors, I mean, I think there are very few prosecutors who go about deliberately prosecuting someone they think is innocent. I think it's hard to do the job and to believe that. So most of the time, prosecutors believe, or they convince themselves, that the person they're prosecuting is guilty. But then they come across evidence that may disturb a jury and maybe make the jury think that a witness is not telling the truth because he's made contradictory statements in the past, and the prosecutor has to decide whether or not to turn over that evidence and possibly risk losing a trial that he thinks he should win, or holding it back and violating his obligations. And unfortunately, we've found that in far too many cases that prosecutors cannot resist the temptation to hold it back.
Well, what you're describing is a system in which prosecutors have an enormous amount of power, far more power in the system than certainly than defendants or criminal defense attorneys have. What's the history of this depositing of so much power in the prosecution's camp, and is there any are there protections available, and what's the history of those protections, if they exist, that will protect us from prosecutors who abuse that power?
Well, back in the 19th century, a lot of prosecutions well, first of all, the federal government had very little power in this area. Almost all prosecutions were local in the individual states and by the individual states. And in many cases, we had part-time prosecutors or private lawyers who were deputized and became prosecutors. And as the 20th century developed, for the position of public prosecutor became institutionalized. What happened as the 20th century went on is that the federal government began to develop more and more of a role in the criminal justice system. Many more laws were passed that made conduct federal crimes as opposed to merely local crimes. And then came in the 1980s the war on drugs, and that really made a huge change in the balance of power in our criminal justice system. In order to fight the war against drugs, politicians competed with each other to see who could give more power to the government and in passing laws that made it easier to prosecute and made the crimes more punished more severely. And we had two things happen. One was the passage of mandatory minimum sentencing laws, under which if a person was involved in originally they were mostly drug crimes. A drug crime with a certain amount of drugs involved, then there was a mandatory minimum sentence, which in New York under the Rockefeller drug law, this happened in the 1970s, I believe, if someone was involved in possessing or selling 2 or 4 ounces of cocaine, they were facing a minimum of 15 years in prison and a maximum of life. And then in the federal system, there were mandatory minimums of 5 or 10 years going up to life for people not only who possessed drugs or sold drugs, but assisted in some way, sometimes a very minor way, others who were more involved. And so the only way to get around these mandatory minimums is for a prosecutor to agree to waive them. The judge doesn't have the power. Only the prosecutor has the power. And so now you have huge numbers of crimes, and this increased. It spread to sex crimes, violent crimes, racketeering, or conspiracy. And so soon you had huge numbers of crimes, many of them federal crimes, where only the prosecutor had the power to waive the mandatory minimum. And so that gave a huge amount of power to prosecutors and took it away from judges.
Well, they could waive the mandatory minimum, having charged somebody with a more serious offense. They could only do that by entering into a plea bargain. Isn't that right?
Right.
And can you tell us, do you know what percentage of cases today now are plea bargained as opposed to going to trial?
I think the percentages, based on either in state or federal court, vary from 95 to 98%.
That's incredible. That less than 5% of cases, and the fact is I'm aware of what the percentage is in New York State, it's less than 0.5% of all cases actually go to trial, leaving all of the rest, 99.5% of cases, getting resolved by plea bargains or outright dismissals, and most of the vast majority of those by plea bargains. That's not a advocacy system. That's a plea bargain system.
Right. It means that defendants, the reason for that, of course, is that if a defendant goes to trial and loses, he's going to be hit with the mandatory minimum, or we also have a sentencing guideline system where the sentences are extremely high and required by guidelines that the judges, until recently, had no power to get around. And so a criminal defendant knows that if he exercises his constitutional rights to go to trial and to the presumption of innocence and the requirement of a unanimous jury verdict and the right to confront his accuser, all these wonderful constitutional rights that are guaranteed to us by the Bill of Rights, that the end result, if he or she is convicted, is to get slammed with an extremely severe sentence. But that if he takes a deal and is allowed to plead and accepts a plea bargain where he pleads guilty to some to an offense that's somewhat less serious, then all of a sudden he can get a punishment that is less severe. And so it puts a tremendous pressure on criminal defendants in our system to plea bargain. And at the same time, prosecutors can control that process by controlling information. That Supreme Court case that I mentioned before, Brady against Maryland, really only applies for the most part to trials. So prosecutors don't disclose what we call Brady material unless a case looks like it's going to trial.
So let's be clear about that. Brady material is that material which tends to benefit the defense in the trial of its case. Is that right?
Right.
And if the prosecution doesn't turn that over, then the defense may never be aware that the prosecution is in possession of evidence that would tend to benefit it.
That's
well,
right.
where's the notion of doing justice if they withhold, if they have no obligation to turn that over in the 95 to 98% of cases that plead guilty? Where's doing justice there, Joel?
Well, that's sort of a rhetorical question.
Yeah, sort of it is.
I mean, just give an example of what could easily happen, does happen. Let's say someone is charged with a drug offense, assisting somebody in distributing some heroin or cocaine. And because the heroin or cocaine that's distributed by the other person is more than a certain amount, the defendant is facing a mandatory minimum of 10 or 15 years in prison. And let's say that the only source of information, the basis of the charge, is an allegation by some individual who himself was arrested and was forced to cooperate in order to reduce his sentence. And that cooperating individual accuses the defendant. And there may be very little other evidence to implicate the defendant. Now, that cooperating individual may have all sorts of promises that were made to him, pressures applied to him to get him to accuse the defendant. He may have made inconsistent statements about the involvement of the defendant. There may be information that the prosecution has access to that would destroy that witness's credibility at a trial if the information was disclosed to the defense. But generally, prosecutors do not disclose what we call impeachment information until the case is about to go to trial. So that same prosecutor might go to the defense lawyer, look, your client is facing 10 or 15 years minimum in prison, but I'm willing to offer him a plea bargain that he must accept now of 5 years in prison.
Without ever disclosing that there's information available that completely undermines the prosecution.
Exactly. So the pressure on the defendant is, of course, enormous to plead guilty and to save what could be a near lifetime in prison, whether he's innocent or guilty.
And we know as criminal defense attorneys that it is simply not unusual that innocent people plead guilty to crimes they didn't commit. Isn't that right?
That's right, and this is the reason.
Why would somebody do that?
Well, for this reason, yeah. Because if they have to make a calculation about the risks of going to trial versus the certainty of a less serious punishment.
But when they make that calculation, what you're telling us is that they're not able to make that calculation based on all the available information because the prosecution is entitled and does withhold information that ought to be available to a person who's contemplating going to jail for a significant amount of time.
That's right. I mean, some DA's offices in New York, I believe that Bronx and Queens are two examples, have plea bargaining policies where if the defendant does not accept a plea bargain prior to being indicted, then he will be indicted for all the crimes that can be shown in the grand jury, and then if he ever wants to plead guilty, it will be required to plead to the maximum charge. And so the pressure there is to totally in the blind as far as knowing what kind of case the prosecution has. The pressure is to plead guilty without any discovery at all. I mean, there's certain kinds of information or documents or evidence that prosecutors are required to turn over to the defense after an indictment that's known as discovery material. This is different from Brady material. It's like results of scientific tests, certain kinds of physical evidence, whether the defendant has made any statements to police, any identifications, that kind of thing. And pre-indictment, none of that has to be turned over. So here, in this system, defendants are totally in the blind about what the case is against them, and they have to decide whether or not to accept the plea bargain, and they're told that if they don't accept the plea bargain, then they're going to have the book thrown at them, and they'll never be offered any kind of reduction.
So you have, over the past several years, represented several individuals who you learned after they were convicted that the prosecution even then didn't disclose information that should have been turned over. Can you tell us what some of those cases, how those cases happened, how you became aware of them, and what resulted from your intervention in those cases?
Well, one of the first cases I got involved in involved the withholding of exculpatory evidence of Brady material was the Alberto Ramos case coming out of the Bronx. And there were a series of prosecutions of individuals who had been employed at daycare centers in the Bronx in the mid-1980s. That was a time of hysteria across the country about alleged sexual abuse of children at daycare centers. And all of a sudden, in around 1983 and 1984, there were these prosecutions that occurred all across the country that had never happened before and never happened after. But during that short window of time, there were all these cases brought, and there were five cases brought in the Bronx. Five people were convicted after trial. Every one of them had been offered an extremely lenient, relatively speaking, plea bargain, and every one of them had turned down the plea bargain. Each one had gone to trial, each one had been convicted, and each one had gotten a massive sentence. Alberto was, unlike the others, was only charged with one count. So when he was convicted of the rape of a five-year-old girl, he got the maximum sentence of 8 1/3 to 25 years in prison, and served 7 years in prison when, through a remarkable series of circumstances, we learned, at that time I began to represent him, we learned that the prosecution had withheld evidence that showed that no crime had been committed at all, that the whole thing had been manufactured. The child, the girl's mother, brought a lawsuit against the New York City-run daycare center where Alberto had been employed. And in the course of defending the lawsuit, the insurance company for the city and its attorneys obtained all sorts of documentation that had not been made available to the criminal defense lawyer at the original trial, documentation from the daycare center and documentation from the files of the New York City Human Resources Administration, which showed that this child had basically been led by her mother and by investigators to manufacture the story, that nothing had ever happened. The child consistently had said that nothing happened, and that the child had been observed doing and saying things that indicated that if she had ever been abused, it was probably at home, and certainly not at the daycare center.
Was this all information that the prosecutor was aware of?
Yeah, so the investigation that was done by the defense of the civil case, ironically, in a civil case, one has much more ability to obtain information than in a criminal case.
Where you're only looking for monetary damages, not to try to keep somebody out of jail.
Right. So the information that was obtained by the defense in the civil case was turned over to Alberto and his family, and they turned it over to me. They retained my law firm, and we looked at it, and we found that there was considerable evidence indicating that this evidence had been turned over to the prosecutor. So we did a further investigation. We went back, and we interviewed all the witnesses, and we got all the records from the daycare center, which was now willing to cooperate all these years later with the defense, and filed a motion in court asking to overturn the conviction because of the withholding of the Brady material from the defense. And the judge ordered a hearing, and everybody, including the prosecutor, testified at the hearing. And the judge made a finding that the prosecution, in fact, did have all this information and had not turned it over and overturned the conviction.
And Mr. Ramos, by that point in time, had spent some time in jail?
Yeah, he had spent 7 horrible years in prison. And I say horrible because when one is convicted of child sexual abuse, no one has a tougher time in prison than someone like that.
And at the end of your hearing, was he released?
He was released, and after the 7 years, and then the district attorney's office, which didn't want to admit that it did anything wrong, appealed, and he had to live through 2 more years of anxiety before the appellate division affirmed or upheld what the lower court had done, and wrote a very strong opinion condemning the misconduct of the DA's office, including the fact that they had even appealed at all.
Well, I'm certain that once that misconduct was identified by a federal judge and then underlined by the appellate division, I'm sure the prosecutor in that case was sanctioned in some way. They must have been punished for that sort of behavior. Why don't you tell us exactly what happened to that prosecutor?
Well, this was all done through the state system. There was a state judge who made these findings, and then the appellate division affirmed. And the appellate division not only hears criminal appeals, but it also has an arm or a division that oversees the conduct of all attorneys in New York State. And the disciplinary committee of this appellate division, on its own, after the judge issued his decision, decided to review the conduct of the prosecutor. And unfortunately, the disciplinary process is done totally in secret. Theoretically, that's to protect the rights of lawyers who are falsely accused of ethical violations.
Unlike defendants who are falsely accused of crimes.
Right, that's very public.
Right. But we had a secret process by which the disciplinary committee looked at the prosecutor's behavior. And what did they find, Joel?
Well, they interviewed the prosecutor. They never interviewed anybody on our side. They made no independent investigation. She came in and made a self-serving denial that she had done anything wrong, even though the hearing judge in the appellate division had said that she had done many things very wrong. And the appellate division, the grievance committee, the disciplinary committee, dismissed the charges.
And, so at the end of the day, there's no sanction, there's no punishment, zero. For somebody who intentionally withheld information, causing Mr. Ramos to spend 7 incredibly difficult years in jail, was there some financial compensation for him?
Well, we brought a lawsuit in 1995 after his case had been fully dismissed, and it was a rather novel lawsuit at the time because prosecutors have immunity from civil suits. They can do anything they want when they're prosecuting a case, no matter how illegal, and they cannot be sued.
So they not only can they not be sued, but they've demonstrated as well that they're not going to be held responsible for violating the civil rights of individuals. They're not going to be sanctioned professionally either. But you brought a civil suit seeking monetary damages, and what happened?
Well, we brought the civil suit on the theory that while the individual assistant district attorney could not be sued, that we could sue New York City under the Federal Civil Rights Act because the district attorney of the Bronx is a city official, and the district attorney had a policy encouraging by doing nothing against prosecutorial misconduct. In other words, there were many instances in the Bronx over many years where courts found that prosecutors had committed violations of rights similar to what happened in the Ramos case, but the district attorney was indifferent to those violations, never disciplined or did anything against the prosecutors, and that created a climate or an unlawful policy of toleration.
So you needed
that caused this prosecutor to do the same thing.
So you needed in your civil action that you brought on behalf of Mr. Ramos to demonstrate not only that particular prosecutor and that particular prosecutor's office in that particular case violated his rights, but you needed to be able to demonstrate that it was the pattern and practice of that prosecutor's office to do that in case after case after case. And you were successful in doing that, weren't you?
Yes. The case almost got dismissed. The lower court judge in the Bronx dismissed most of the case, and then we appealed and gave us very little discovery or information about the history at the Bronx DA's office of discipline or lack of discipline. We then brought an appeal, and the same appellate division that had ruled in our favor in the criminal case now wrote a fantastic, from our point of view, a fantastic decision that's still the leading authority in New York State in this area, which said that we were, in fact, entitled to sue New York City on this theory that not only the failure of the district attorney to ever discipline prosecutors in the past could be used as evidence to show an unlawful policy, but also the fact that they even had appealed the decision in the Ramos case to the appellate court in the first place. That the fact that they appealed and made totally unjustified arguments showed that they had an unlawful policy. It was evidence of the policy. And they also ruled that we were entitled to get all the disciplinary and personnel records of prosecutors involved in a total of 72 cases in which the courts had found misconduct in order to see whether we could prove that there was a lack of discipline.
Well, and you got those 72 cases, you got that material, and you looked at it, and in how many of those cases, Joel, was there discipline as a result of prosecutorial misconduct?
Well, we got that material around the year 2001, I believe, and the material went back to the late 70s. The only instance in which any prosecutor had ever been disciplined, I believe, was in 1979. That prosecutor was suspended from work for, I believe it was 2 months after he had been cited in about four separate cases for a series of outrageous misdeeds. And the district attorney suspended him for 2 months, wrote to the appellate division, disciplinary committee, that he had taken care of it internally, that they shouldn't do anything, and they didn't. And then when this prosecutor was restored to service, he was almost immediately given a series of raises, including merit bonuses, which more than made up for the 2 month salary that he had been docked. And that was the sole instance in over 20 years and well over 70 cases of any prosecutor who had ever been disciplined.
So you were able to use that information then when you got back to the trial level in your civil rights case to demonstrate to the court that that there was a pattern in practice of permitting prosecutorial misconduct. And what happened with that case at the end of the day?
Well, after we finished discovery and we were looking at the prospect of a trial, the city decided to settle, and they paid Mr. Ramos $5 million. And that was too much money to turn down, so he accepted the settlement. And so the case never went to trial, but we were able, to that point, to expose the lack of discipline and the indifference at this district attorney's office to misconduct by prosecutors, particularly where they withheld evidence.
But even with the payment, and what a terrific result for Mr. Ramos, though the price he had to pay for that was just devastating. But even upon the payment of $5 million by the city to Mr. Ramos for this sorts of behavior, was there ever an acknowledgement on the part of the city that they had, in fact, done something wrong?
No.
Where does that arrogance come from? I don't get it. We elect these people, don't we?
Yeah, the city will never, the only time that the city will ever apologize, perhaps, is in the DNA type case where, or where the DA's office will ever apologize, is in a DNA case where the defendant can be shown 100% to be innocent. There cannot be any dispute about it whatsoever. And so everybody in the system knows that an innocent person has been wronged, and so in that kind of case, there's often an apology, but there's never an apology where someone has been convicted because the prosecution or the police in some way distorted the way the system is supposed to work.
Well, but this Ramos case that grew out of child abuse allegations was just the first of several that you've been involved with. You actually have a paralegal working in your office who was vindicated by you as well. Isn't that right?
Yeah, Jabbar Collins is now working for me, but he spent 16 and a half years in prison. And while in prison, he educated himself in the law and became a rather noted jailhouse lawyer. And he was able to use the Freedom of Information Act and other investigative tools from prison, which is extraordinarily difficult, to obtain a great deal of information about his case and how the witnesses in his case were coerced and the promises were made to them or the fact of how they were coerced was never disclosed to the defense. And a federal judge about a year and a half ago, after he had been in prison for 16 years, overturned his conviction. And the conduct was so egregious and pervasive that the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office had to agree to overturn the conviction, but to dismiss all charges. He was never retried. The case was fully dismissed, and I then hired him to do some of his magic in my office.
And so the sort of information that the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office withheld in the original prosecution of Jabbar Collins included their knowing reliance on the false testimony of witnesses. And here again, we've got a state actor, a prosecutor who's paid for by the people of the state of New York, knowingly putting forward perjured testimony. And I have to believe that that Charlie Hines looked at that prosecutor and said, you know what, you're done here. At least fired them, right?
Well, the prosecutor who was responsible for the prosecution is the chief of his rackets bureau and has been there for many years and is a very powerful individual in the office. And when the on the day that the district attorney's office was acknowledging at least some of the misconduct that had occurred and agreed that the case should be overturned and dismissed, the prosecutor in court, who is now representing the DA's office, made a statement defending everything that had been done by all the prosecutors involved in the case. And then Mr. Hines was interviewed by the news media, and he said that there'd be no investigation, that no one had done anything knowingly wrong, and he was 100% behind the prosecutors involved in the case, which is ironic because, as I understand it, Mr. Hines is now saying that he has, for the last 2 years, he's had a committee of some sort to review allegations of prosecutorial misconduct, and it doesn't appear that there was any review made in this case. I don't know what review he's made in other cases.
And for all the years that Mr. Collins spent in jail, has there been any monetary compensation for him?
Well, we've brought a lawsuit, two lawsuits, one in the federal district court and one in the state court of claims, alleging that his conviction was caused by the misconduct of police in the district attorney's office, and the city is very vigorously fighting against our lawsuit, and so it's proceeding slowly, and I'm confident about where it'll end up, but the city is, as it generally does, is fighting against the lawsuit very, very strongly in order to try to avoid having to pay out any money.
Despite the fact that a federal judge has already ruled that they violated the rules.
Yeah, well, I think that the approach of the city and its attorneys, even in cases where they know or they should know that there was an injustice done, is to fight the case the way lawyers fight cases and to try to do whatever they can to avoid having to pay out any of the city's money.
I guess that's a little different than how you described the prosecutor's obligation at the beginning of our show, that is that they're supposed to do justice.
Yeah, the civil attorneys for the city don't seem to view their job as doing justice, but to advocate for their client. I mean, their role is a little bit different than the criminal prosecutor. The criminal prosecutor, clearly, I mean, the courts have said, has an obligation to do justice. The attorney for the city in a civil case perhaps doesn't have quite the same obligation, but you'd think that there'd be a sense of moral responsibility by the city and the top attorneys for the city to do something to correct injustices that have been done to individuals, but unfortunately they just approach it like any attorney representing a client trying to save the client from having to spend any money.
You know, in this discussion, I'm hearing you describe time and time again, over and over, professionals, attorneys, hired to do a particular job who violate their duty, who break the rules, who use knowingly perjured testimony, and they're not disciplined. I know that our listeners are familiar with medical malpractice cases in which when physicians or healthcare people in the healthcare field are merely negligent, if they do something that isn't up to the standards of care for someone in their profession, they're at risk for losing their license, having their conduct reviewed by the Office of Professional Medical Conduct. They're at risk of a malpractice suit, and we know that physicians, practice in a way that's designed to protect themselves from malpractice suits. We may not, as healthcare consumers, appreciate the fact that physicians practice defensive medicine because they're afraid of getting sued, but I can only imagine that we as citizens might appreciate prosecutors behaving as though they might at some point be held responsible for their at least negligent and in many cases purposeful intentional conduct designed to violate the rights of defendants. Where does this huge disparity come from? Is it just inbred, Joel, that prosecutors feel completely risk-free and so they can flout the rules whenever they want?
Well, the idea of prosecutorial immunity is the first line of defense that prosecutors have that gives them a feeling of omnipotence.
So prosecutorial immunity meaning individuals cannot sue an individual prosecutor regardless of their behavior.
Right. And the reason for that is a policy decision that the Supreme Court made some years ago in a case that involved the Federal Civil Rights Act, where the Supreme Court said that we cannot have prosecutors whose job it is to make difficult decisions to protect the whole community, which is a difference from physicians. I mean, a physician makes a mistake, and as horrible as it is, it generally affects one person. If a prosecutor makes a mistake and to bend over backwards to help a criminal defendant, say, for fear of being sued, the result might be that a mass murderer gets released or a terrible person gets released back into the community. The prosecutor has to make decisions that involve the protection of the whole community and the way our laws are enforced. So the Supreme Court made a policy decision that it was going to recognize absolute immunity for prosecutors the way judges have absolute immunity, and justified it by pointing out that prosecutors, unlike police officers, for example, are subject to professional discipline because there's a code of professional responsibility, and if they violate that code, they will be disciplined by their peers or by the courts. And ironically, what we've seen over the last 25 years since the Supreme Court made that pronouncement is that prosecutors are almost never disciplined, but police officers are much more frequently than prosecutors. So ironically, in our system, police officers can be sued, even though there are disciplinary mechanisms such as the Civilian Complaint Review Board or internal administrative charges brought by the police department, where prosecutors violate the law. But when prosecutors violate the law or their obligations, they're almost never disciplined.
So what's to be done? I mean, the people who are charged with crimes in our world are our brothers and fathers and mothers and sisters. They're our family. They're the people we know. They're the people we see on the street every day. What can we do to protect ourselves from prosecutors who feel, and for good reason, invincible and able to violate people's rights when they choose to?
Well, thanks to the work of the Innocence Project, we know that our society has become much more sensitized to the fact that innocent people are convicted. And in a case where DNA shows that someone's absolutely innocent, we've been able to go back and to look at what went wrong in those cases. And a lot of times what goes wrong is that some protection of the criminal justice system has been weakened or not implemented, such as rules against coerced confessions or against suggestive identifications. And a lot of times people are wrongfully convicted because prosecutors have withheld evidence under the Brady rule. So there's been a lot more attention in the last 10 years or so to the causes of wrongful convictions and to prosecutorial misconduct. And there has been, particularly with the Senator Stevens case from Alaska, the trial that occurred.
So give us a little background on Senator Stevens' case. He was a senator who was charged with corruption.
Yeah, a senator from Alaska who was charged with corruption, I think having to do with some diversion of funds to a home construction project that he had, and there was evidence that the United States Attorney's Office had that was inconsistent with guilt. and with the credibility of his main accuser.
And they withheld that information.
They withheld that information, and it eventually came out, and a federal judge ordered an investigation, and it was a massive investigation into what had happened and why it happened, and a report was ultimately issued that, just a brilliant report that reconstructed the entire case and showed where the prosecutors had withheld information and how important that was.
Though, of course, Senator Stevens' career was decimated. He was convicted, and thereafter the conviction was reversed, but he didn't actually live long enough to see the benefit of the reversal, because he died tragically in a plane accident shortly after that. But what has happened with the finding of the misbehavior of the federal prosecutors who withheld information?
Well, it's focused a lot more attention on this whole problem. And there's a bill that's been introduced in Congress over the last few weeks to require that Brady material be disclosed and to have real sanctions against the prosecutors if they don't disclose it. There are bills that are being proposed in various state legislatures across the country.
Can you back up for 1 second, Joe? When you say real sanctions against the prosecutors if they don't disclose it, what kind of sanction are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about sanctions within the criminal case.
Yeah, right. We're still not talking about holding a professional prosecutor personally responsible for purposefully destroying somebody's life by violating the rules.
Right. Well, that has to be something that comes from the court system. It can come from the legislature. There can be a law enacted that makes that a crime, or that makes it clear that it's a type of conduct that should be disciplined administratively, that a person can lose his license. That has to come from the legislature or from the courts, and that's only going to happen if the public expresses its dismay and applies pressure. And that does happen every time there's a highly publicized injustice and people can relate to the individual who's been had his life ruined. But the problem is that we live in a 24-hour news cycle, and 24 hours later, everyone's on to the next outrage or the next colorful story in our society, and people forget.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you that I thought you were going in the direction that I hoped you would go in, where you said that you know people's attention is drawn when they can relate to the individual, and certainly when the individual is someone like a wealthy white United States senator who's subjected to this kind of behavior. The result is an incredibly in-depth inquiry, and finally, the promulgation of some potential legislation that begins to address this issue. But let me ask you, Joel, when you represented Mr. Ramos, or when you represented Mr. Collins, or several of the other defendants who you represented, whose rights were torn apart in ways far more heinous than Mr. Stevens, what sort of legislation did anybody promulgate at that point? And of course, my another rhetorical question on my part, we all know the answer is zero. And don't we know really that the answer is zero in large measure because these were young Hispanic, African-American men who have no constituency backing them up? And unfortunately for Senator Stevens, but perhaps fortunately for us, those people who make the rules can indeed relate to him, where they might not relate so much to Mr. Ramos or Jabbar Collins.
Well, what you say is very true, and what I've tried to do in my career is to follow up these injustices by bringing these lawsuits, which try to show the poison in the overall system. And the wonderful thing about the federal civil rights statute is that it contemplates a system of private attorney generals who try to bring sunlight upon government malpractice that the government itself is unwilling to shine upon itself. And so I can, as when I bring one of these lawsuits for Jabbar Collins, Alberto Ramos, I've been involved in quite a few of them now, I can use the discovery provisions of federal law and the federal civil rights statute to force the district attorney's office to disclose information that otherwise would never be disclosed, and to try to shine a light upon a pattern of misconduct and indifference to misconduct, and in the hope that it'll produce some reform and some change. And I do think that, I mean, that there's been a lot more attention to this subject. We did have a, we now have a permanent committee appointed by the Chief Judge of the New York State Court of Appeals on wrongful convictions, and one of the areas I trust they'll look into is the discovery provisions and withholding of evidence. We had a hearing that was conducted 2 years ago by a committee of the New York State Bar Association on wrongful convictions that also looked into Brady violations and withholding of evidence. So there is more of an interest in this area, and I think it's gradually moving in the right direction, but it's just a painfully slow process.
Well, I want to, in the last couple of minutes that we have, Joel, and before we move on, I know that you told us that Mr. Ramos was able to at least obtain some financial remuneration for the terrible injustice done to him. You also represented a young man in Queens who was charged with attempted murder and convicted, Shay Wei Su. His conviction was overturned as well because the Queens district attorney unknowingly relied on what they knew to be false cooperating witness testimony and obtained a conviction that they should never have obtained. You represented him in that federal civil lawsuit for the unlawful Brady policies, that is, the failure of the Queens district attorney's office to reveal what they knew to be evidence in favor of the defendant's position. And that case as well resulted in a significant monetary resolution for Mr. Su. Isn't that correct?
Yes, in that case, we showed over a period of time that there have been 84 reported decisions, many involving similar withholding of evidence or misconduct by the prosecutor, where not a single prosecutor in the 15 or so years that were involved, not a single prosecutor was disciplined. And that not only that, but Queens and all the other DA's offices in New York that I've studied do not have any system for it. They don't have any personnel manual that involves discipline. They have no rules of discipline. They have no procedure for investigating or disciplining employees. I mean, imagine a corporation having 1,000 employees, having no personnel manual with a provision for discipline, no system for discipline. It's astounding. It's just an astounding arrogance that the district attorney's offices have, that they are somehow above the law and the rules that apply to everyone else don't apply to them.
Can you tell us what the ultimate recovery for Mr. Su was?
$3.5 million.
And how much time did he spend in jail before his conviction was also vacated by a federal court?
12 years.
And
$3.5 million is much too little for 12 years in prison.
Incredible. And again, in that case, how many district attorneys were fired or disciplined as a result of their misbehavior?
Nobody was fired or disciplined except that the prosecutor involved got what's known as an admonition, which is the lowest possible penalty that the grievance committee can administer. And it's private, it's confidential. No one, except for the fact that the lawsuit brought it out, nobody ever would have known about it. And Mr. Su protested that through some secret process that did not involve him in any way, that they arrived at this resolution. And ironically, they told Mr. Su that if he wanted to complain about it, he should sue. So he did sue.
Good for him.
And he recovered $3.5 million. But the point is that you have a whole regime where the Supreme Court says that we don't need to have lawsuits against individual prosecutors because we have a disciplinary system. And then the disciplinary system says if you want to complain about a prosecutor, then bring a lawsuit.
Right.
The whole thing is it's upside down.
Joel, we're coming to the end of our hour together, and I want to thank you so much for agreeing to spend your Sunday morning with us this way. I'm imagining that there are Some people among our listening audience who have concerns that they'd like to be able to discuss with you, how might they reach you if they'd like to be able to do that?
Well, I have an email. It's jbrudin, R-U-D-I-N, at AOL.com, one of the last AOL users.
Great. And you have an office in New York City?
Yes, on West 57th Street in New York City.
And the phone number for that office is?
212-752-7600.
Terrific. Joel, I think that I figured out why my musical segment at the beginning didn't work, and I want to say that I know that, like all criminal defense lawyers, you stand by your clients because it's the right thing to do. And if anybody ever wonders how we do this kind of work, I commend this song to them. Thanks a lot, Joel. Have a great day.
All right, you too.
No matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point you're gonna need somebody to stand by you.
Just as long as your people come and stand.